the Constitution, he said, I don't know. Claudia de la Cruz says, Trump and his cabinet full of billionaires are waging an all-out war on our communities, from slashing thousands of jobs to massively defunding critical programs that many working-class people rely on to survive. At this critical moment, she says, we can't simply lay down and allow his administration to roll back all the rights that our people's movements have won. Now is the time to organize our communities and stand up to fight back. Unquote. In these dark times, we cannot be bystanders. We must resist and imagine and create a new world where peace, equality, dignity, and justice are the norm. Our guest today is Claudia de la Cruz. She's an educator and community organizer. For nearly 30 years, she's worked on building people power locally, nationally, and internationally. In 2024, she ran for President of the United States, representing the Party of Socialism and Liberation. She's the Executive Director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization. She spoke in May 2025 in Boulder as part of her Fighting the Billionaire Coup, We Won't Back Down tour. And now, Claudia de la Cruz.
This is Kevin Amos, and welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Here are more developments for this week in the news with various news clips. First up is from Native Land Podcasters.
But Andrew, I know that you too think that we should memorialize him using his own words.
Oh, for sure, which is why that's what we'll do right now. Let's hear who Charlie Kirk was in life.
Comparing abortion to the Holocaust.
Absolutely, I am. In fact, it's worse. It's worse.
Were these blacks trying to go rob her? Happening all the time in urban America. Prowling blacks go around for fun to go target white people. That's a fact. Black crime is a major issue in our country. Why are you pushing criminal justice reform exactly?
Joy Reid and Michelle Obama and Sheila Jackson Lee and Ketanji Brown Jackson, they're coming out and they're saying, I'm only here because of affirmative action. Yeah, we know. You do not have the brain processing power to otherwise be taken really seriously. You had to go steal a white person's slot to go be taken somewhat seriously.
Now, the southern border is, of course, the great replacement. They're trying to replace us demographically. They're trying to make the country less white. It is an anti-white agenda. If I see a black pilot, I'm going to be like, boy, I hope he's qualified. Taylor Swift is now engaged to Travis Kelce. This is something that I hope will make Taylor Swift more conservative. Reject feminism. Submit to your husband, Taylor. You're not in charge.
America was at its peak when we halted immigration for 40 years and we dropped our foreign-born percentage to its lowest level ever.
Miss Rachel, you quote Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. The chapter before affirms God's perfect law when it comes to sexual matters. In Leviticus 18 is that thou shall lay with another man shall be stoned to death. Can we get that picture up, Ryan, of that Marvel's Avenger team? Now, I don't know who the person is on the left. Is the person on the left that that came and did the interview with Joe?
Nice.
The TikTok, your government is being run by freaks. It's like immediately I have like a flashback to a country where weren't able to do Bud Light commercials. What does being trans even mean? Is that even a real thing? It means you need therapy. We must ban trans-affirming care the entire country.
I do think that there is a direct correlation between someone's testosterone and their politics. On young men, the lower their testosterone, the more likely they are to be Democratic.
So if you had a daughter and she was 10 and she got raped and she was going to give birth and she would, and she was going to give birth and she was going to live. Would you want her to go through that and carry her baby?
That's awfully graphic.
It's a real life scenario that happens to many people.
The answer is yes, the baby would be delivered.
when blacks in America did not have the same rights they had today. They were less murderous. There was less break-ins. Why is that?
So I'm sorry. Are you trying to say that blacks thrive under subjugation?
No, I'm not. I'm saying I'm asking you the question. The data shows they were actually better in the 1940s. It was bad. It was evil. But what happened? Something changed.
I'm done talking about Epstein for the time being. I'm going to trust my friends, the administration.
So clearly y'all can hear the pure hatred, the indecency, the inhumanity, the trafficking, and just the most gutterous form of not even politics, of humanity, you know, that we have to live with. But I'll tell you, I worked for a civil liberties organization for the majority of my working life, People for the American Way. And part of our founder, Norman Lear's, you know, real premise was the fact that even a Charlie Kirk, would we have to defend his ability to say whatever the hell he thinks and believes, even if it is something that we disagree with vehemently. And in truth, the right used to hold up the banner that said, you know, these liberal, touchy-feely, woke, what is the other one? The cancel culture. And now these are the same people who are attempting to regulate what it is that we say, to redefine free speech as no freedom to speak at all. Let's hear from our top cop, top prosecutor, and what she and this administration have to say about that.
There's free speech and then there's hate speech. And there is no place, especially now, especially after what happened to Charlie, in our society.
Do you see more law enforcement going after these groups who are using hate speech and putting cuffs on people so we show them that some action is better than no action?
We will absolutely target you, go after you if you are targeting anyone with hate speech, anything. And that's across the aisle.
You know, love it or hate it, hate speech, unfortunately, is still protected speech and under the Constitution and by the Supreme Court. But I will say this. There's a lot troubling about what Pam Bondi said there. But I was struck first by her saying, we will absolutely, especially after what happened to Charlie Kirk, as if she wasn't around 3, 4, 5 weeks ago when legislators were struck down in their beds, practically, in the middle of the night, awoken by right-wing extremists coming to kill them. And, you know, by the grace of God, many other legislators were spared. So I tell you, it'd be one thing if you could trust the government to clamp down on, quote, hate speech, if they were actually going to do it justly and rightly and go to the people who are actually provocateurs of hate speech, because that would mean they have to clean out their own bedrooms first. But I have no trust in it. And where I see us going now with this attorney general / personal counsel to Donald Trump is the weaponizing of all of the forces of government, to include stripping people of their 501c3 non-tax tax status organizations, prosecuting presidents of organizations, C3, C4s. And then forget about us, y'all, podcasters, everyday folks who are out just demanding justice in their community, who are now being accused of hate speech because they happen to disagree with the people who happen to be in government now. I wonder, does that ring alarm bells for y'all? And what warnings do we need to give to our community about the way in which they may now use their power to subjugate us further?
You know, the thing that comes to mind is twofold. One is there's been a lot of conversation on right versus left, but I still think this is a conversation about white versus white. The reason I'm saying that is because the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act was just passed in Congress in 2022.
Yeah.
right? This was just passed in Congress in 2022. And I'm bringing that up to say that the protection of Black people against violent rhetoric and then the violent actions that are taken on the other side of that violent rhetoric was just put into law 3 years ago. We have to have the conversation that many have been afraid to. I don't think that this is along ideological lines. This is a race battle. This is one where there are governors of progressive, liberal, and even moderate Democratic states, so left states, that have flags flying at half mast or that were flying at half mast in honor of this man's contributions to society, even when those contributions resulted in death threats to people we love like Tiff. I think that is something we have to wrestle with. Why is it that someone who can cause such great, grave harm to people who look like us be celebrated and given a hero's welcome? Why is it that the Confederate soldiers, folks who they read about with glory, even though we know the real story, get celebrated, statues, schools named after them, streets named after them, all of the things that are being talked about, someone who frankly utilized Confederate ideology in his podcast regularly, right? Like, how is that something that we should protect, honor, and lift up? I think that that is something that really has to be wrestled with in this country. And it is highly problematic. And it is absolutely violent. It is the kind of thing where it felt like to me we were being gaslit for the last week.
Yeah.
Literally since we walked off air on our podcast. I'm just like, what are they seeing about this human being that I do not see? When I hear what he says, it sounds harmful. When I hear what he says, it sounds like it's, I know it's a lie. You know, like talking about our brain processing power, those are things that they did in faux genetic studies for years under the guise of medical, you know, care. The way that they practiced on our bodies and experimented on us, all of those things are racist. And those are the very things, racial eugenics, that he's lifting up, right? So anyway, I just think it's not a right versus left conversation.
Well,
it's a white versus white conversation.
I hear you. I absolutely hear you. I will say, though, I think it's different saying that a person we don't celebrate or lift up the murder of people who happen to we happen to disagree with or be on the opposite side of us. I think that's sure. A hard line, period. Enough said. Sure. That's my statement there. But I also agree with you that this idea, the honorifics that have been extended by the American on behalf of the American taxpayer has been mind boggling. I can agree that you should not be killed for your political beliefs. And at the same time, I can say, I do not believe that American taxpayer dollars should have been used to fly a private citizen's body in an American aircraft with such dignity and honorifics that were extended by this administration.
Andrew, you don't take issue with political beliefs. Like, to me, what he said,
I do take issue with that. The problem is there are people who disagree as vehemently with the things we believe.
But I'm saying what he spewed wasn't political beliefs. It was
a political belief to the extent that it drove them to the conclusion that that is why DEI should not exist. And that is why we shouldn't put Black people on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that is why we shouldn't have Black pilots, male or female, flying commercial airliners and jets of large proportion. So when their racist beliefs lead to public policy prescripts, then absolutely you're going to hear from me on all sides of it, because consequentially, I could deal with a person who hates me because of the color of my skin, but don't have the power to do shit about it.
But I guess what I'm saying,
different
yeah.
exception
it's
with
not
the person
just political
who can hate
consequences,
me.
Though. It's not. I guess what I'm saying.
No. I agree that it's not just political consequences. I completely agree. I think about Ruby Freeman and her daughter and the terror that they had to exist and try to survive through at the hands of the Trump a presidential campaign yeah. and their lingering folks. Oh, I get what it means for us down deep, But what I'm saying, the reason why where you gonna hear from me is when your belief system and your disparaging belief about me, my wife, my family, the conditions in which we live and the values of which we hold is when they lead to a political outcome that then disenfranchises me, that then creates the permission structure for my murder, that then creates the permission structure for me to be fired for without cause, with no justification, simply because of the color of my skin.
And that's what I'm saying. The ramifications are far beyond politics. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying his belief system is one that impacted nonprofit and philanthropic giving. It impacted whether or not there was DEI policy in the federal government, in state and local governments, and in corporations. It impacted whether or not kids could be admitted to school. And sure, we can say that even a court decision is a policy-based, could have policy-based impacts and is therefore political. But what I don't want to do, hopefully in this conversation, is limit this man's rhetoric and dangerous impact on society to squarely political, because it was so far beyond politics.
Well, as a political scientist, politics is, again, about the study of people. So it isn't necessarily derivative of whether or not that study has implications on public policy. So I understand that you don't want us to talk strictly in that vein. All the reason, I have to say, why I think politics can't even begin to completely encapsulate the danger.
Yeah. I agree with that. The danger presented,
and that's why his murder matters, is because of, in life, the way in which he could impact our everyday existence in this country simply by his utterances, as ignorant as they were.
I think
he got JD elected, got Trump reelected, got, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think you I understand your point, Andrew. I really do. I deeply connect with your point, Angela. And I think you both are, you know, Angela, you might be starting here and Andrew, you pick up here. We're both all going the same direction in the same lane.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Our next piece is from PBS, and it's from a series called Rogue History. Very interesting things to check out here.
Thomas Peters was embarking on a dangerous voyage, but by the time the ship left Nova Scotia in the summer of 1790, he had already endured slavery, escaped his chains, and served bravely with the British Army. This was not a man who shrank from danger. Now, he was on his way to challenge the British government directly on the promises it had broken. His courage would soon make him the father of a nation. I'm Joel Cook, and this is Rogue History. Rebels and Revolutionaries. Thomas's story began in present-day Nigeria, where he was born an Egba prince in 1738. Though the details of his life in his homeland aren't well known, he was likely educated and influential. But unfortunately for Thomas, slave traders didn't really care. He was kidnapped, forced onto a ship, and sold away to French Louisiana at age 22. Now, as you might imagine, a prince didn't take too kindly to being sold halfway around the planet to harvest sugarcane. His first escape attempt resulted in a severe whipping, which probably isn't the best way to convince someone they should stay. After a second attempt, he was branded, and after the third, put in heavy shackles that prevented him from moving easily around the plantation. But Thomas remained unbroken, and it seems that his enslavers knew it. A few years after his enslavement in Louisiana, he was sold to William Campbell of Wilmington, North Carolina, where he shifted from the brutal work of the sugarcane fields to life as an enslaved millwright. The work required him to repair and construct the mills that powered industry in and around Wilmington. By the summer of 1775, slaveholders up and down the Atlantic coast panicked as rumors spread that the British were encouraging enslaved people to rebel against their oppressors. And honestly, it wasn't a rumor. Though the British still held millions of enslaved people within their empire, they recognized how important slavery was to the survival of the American independence movement. If they could break the system, they could win the war. The Wilmington Committee of Safety responded to this threat by banning the import of new enslaved people, disarming every black person in the city, and even declaring martial law. But none of this deterred Thomas. In November 1775, the British Royal Governor of Virginia issued the Dunmore Proclamation, which guaranteed freedom to any enslaved person willing to fight against their patriot enslavers. Thomas finally had the opportunity he'd been waiting for. He just needed a chance to act on it. That moment came a few months later when British warships attacked Wilmington. While no one knows for certain how Thomas and his family escaped, it's likely that they and other freedom seekers stole boats and rowed out to the safety of the British fleet. By the next fall, Thomas, his wife Sally, and their children were safe in New York, but not yet free. Though the terms were a little better, the British still wanted to use black labor just as much as the Americans did. Thomas enlisted in the Black Pioneers and Guides, a unit that provided scouts, raiders, and construction laborers to the British Army. The soldiers received the same rations and pay as their British counterparts, but weren't trained in military combat despite often being in the line of fire. Even worse, the Americans made it their mission to terrorize black soldiers. When a British unit was ambushed in South Carolina, the Americans put a black pioneer's head on a stake as a warning. But despite all of these risks, Thomas thrived as a black pioneer. He was wounded twice by the Americans, but his willpower and natural leadership skills pushed him up the ranks to become one of three black sergeants in the unit by the end of the war. As we all know, the British lost in the end, but still honored their promise to liberate the thousands of black people who supported them. In November 1783, Thomas and his family joined a massive evacuation of 3,000 black loyalists bound for British-ruled Nova Scotia. Now, I know, this is the part of the story where you're expecting me to tell you that the prince who survived slavery, saved his family from it, fought in a war, and escaped to the Great White North lived happily ever after. But he didn't, and it was all because of fake friends. The most important part of starting a new life in Nova Scotia was land ownership. British royal policy promised former loyalists 200 acres if they were a non-commissioned officer, 100 if they were regular soldiers or civilian heads of family, and 50 for each additional family member. For Thomas, his wife, and their two children, that meant they should have received 300 acres of land to start their new life on. But they didn't receive any, and neither did many other black loyalists. When they did receive land, it was often bad for farming and difficult to build on. After a famine set in, people in black settlements were forced to trade the clothes off their backs for food, and many still starved in the streets. Others survived by agreeing to indentured servitude contracts with white loyalists that were barely better than the slavery they escaped. In fact, many white loyalists turned a tidy profit by selling these indentured servants to ships or body snatchers looking to re-enslave them in the U.S. or Caribbean. Things got so bad that some black loyalists fled back to the northern U.S., straight up enemy territory, to find safety from their former comrades. But Thomas didn't. To no one's surprise, he immediately stepped up as a leader of the movement for black loyalist rights. He went first to Governor John Parr, the governor of Nova Scotia, in 1784, with a petition to finally grant black loyalists the lands they were owed. It didn't go over well. After repeated attempts to change Parr's mind over the next few years, Thomas traveled to New Brunswick in 1790 to petition its governor with the same request. The governor waxed poetic about treating black people and white people the same in his province. But when Thomas asked about quality land, he had to admit the crown had reserved it for white loyalists. 7 years after being promised a new life in Nova Scotia, black loyalists were slowly watching it wither away. It was time to escalate the situation. In the fall of 1790, Thomas Peters was selected by community members to deliver a petition to British Foreign Minister William Grenville on behalf of over 200 black loyalist families. And by deliver, I do mean deliver. Petitioners didn't have change.org back in the day. Thomas would have to sail from Nova Scotia to London on board a ship where he could easily be re-enslaved. If he even survived the trip, he, a formerly enslaved millwright, was expected to walk into the offices of the most powerful empire in the world and hold them accountable for their failure to keep their word. And of course, that's exactly what he did. Thomas's arrival in 1790 couldn't have been better timed. Almost two decades prior, abolitionists successfully banned slavery in England. Now, Parliament was considering legislation to ban slavery completely throughout the British colonies. Thomas's life experience meshed perfectly with the movement's central points. And it also helped that our guy came with some serious references. A letter of introduction from none other than Major General Henry Clinton, who described Thomas as a very active sergeant in a very useful corps. Between his meetings with the abolitionists and British officials, Thomas heard about an opportunity that just might work for his friends and family back home. The end of slavery in England left thousands of formerly enslaved people in much the same conditions as black loyalists in Nova Scotia. To solve this problem, the Committee for the Relief of the Black Poor, headed by famed abolitionist Granville Sharp, suggested the voluntary relocation of poor black people to Sierra Leone in West Africa. And the bill approving the Sierra Leone colony passed in 1791 while Thomas Peters was in London. Now, of course, there were problems with this whole Sierra Leone situation. Most obvious among them that Sierra Leone wasn't empty. There were thousands of Native Africans living in the area who had no say in the formation of the colony. But for Thomas, who had seen his people terrorized for nearly a decade in their own promised land, there didn't seem to be a better option. In 1791, he sailed back to Nova Scotia alongside abolitionist John Clarkson to recruit black loyalists for the colony. Now, white loyalists took that as a threat, and Governor Parr, the same governor who denied the land petition in 1784, was furious with Thomas for exposing his failures as a leader. Local officials and white citizens who had once attacked black residents for accepting low-wage labor now physically attacked Thomas for taking that labor away. They also refused to settle debts or end indentured servant contracts for those who wanted to leave. Despite these difficulties, Thomas successfully signed up 1,200 black loyalists, which represented the overwhelming majority of the ones who had a choice, according to black loyalist scholar Dr. James W. St. George Walker. But his work wasn't done yet. Thomas and John Clarkson worked together to inspect the 15 ships. They ordered new beds constructed, ventilation improved, and decks removed. By doing so, Thomas was ensuring that none of his followers, many of whom had experienced the horror of the Middle Passage, would have to feel that discomfort on this voyage. The fleet departed on January 15, 1792, arriving in Sierra Leone 2 months later. After settling in, Thomas wrote his first report back to the British, in which he thanked them for their kindness, described how nice the weather and the sailors were, and then told them that their provisions were trash. He expected better for his people while they started the process of growing their own food. But the issues in the colony weren't just about provisions. John Clarkson and the other abolitionists described Sierra Leone as a place that would provide land for building a new life and a democratic colorblind society that respected black voices. But when they finally arrived in the colony, Thomas often argued with Clarkson over leadership decisions. When black residents voted Thomas into a leadership position, Clarkson accused Thomas of making trouble and charged him with theft in a politically motivated legal trial. The voyage and the difficulty of new life in Sierra Leone seemed to take a toll on Thomas. He began showing signs of illness on June 16, 1792, just after the trial, and died a few days later at just 54 years old. Though Thomas Peters never got to see it, Sierra Leone preserved his legacy. He remains the father of the nation of Sierra Leone, and his statue stands near his gravesite in Freetown today. For people like Thomas Peters, the American Revolution wasn't the independence movement we celebrate today. While his enslavers preached to fight for liberty at their tables, their hypocrisy forced him to pick up arms against the revolution. Thomas's story reminds us that while the American Revolution is called to fight for freedom, that included the freedom to own human beings. For Black Americans who remained in the U.S., their revolution would continue for years to come. If you want to hear more about that, check out our episode on the Knights of Liberty, linked in the description. Then come back and tell us what you think. Till next time.
Okay, is Trump asking us to narc on the National Park Service?
Check out this sign. It reads, "Please let us know if you have identified any signs or other information that are negative about either past or living Americans."
Wait.
You want to see what real independent journalism funded by the people for the people looks like?
You ever heard a story like this in America?
You're looking at it.
Congratulations for always being somewhere where mainstream media is not.
Flint, Michigan.
See you in Nevada.
Thanks to people like you, we could get the truth. Corporate media, they've been lying to us for years, and you're going straight to the people.
You are the man. I'm glad you're here.
For as low as 16 cents a day, you'll keep us on the ground, covering the important stories the corporate media covers up.
Hey, it's Jordan with Status Quo. As President Trump descends further into North Korea, our dear leader, territory, he is now trying to whitewash U.S. history further by erasing the genocide, murder, raping, and kidnappings of Native Americans, along with the horrible stain of slavery. At several other national parks, the Trump administration has ordered the removal of signs and other materials that state the land once belonged to Native Americans tribes, according to one of the people briefed on the matter. Tribes were forcibly removed from lands across the American West that later became national parks. For instance, the U.S. military forced the Shoshone, Bannock, and other tribes from what is now Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. From NPR, this is from an interview NPR did about this. I was talking to Park Service people yesterday, and they were saying that they're looking at more than 1,000 items that employees have reported around the country. That's because the employees are of the Park Service are being pushed by the Trump administration to report these inappropriate signs of our history and remove them. Much of the content revolves around the history of slavery. For instance, the administration wants this graphic photo taken down at one park. It's of an enslaved man who was whipped so hard he has scars on his back, as the Washington Post first reported. This is a historic image of a slave who was basically tortured by the slave master, called the Scourged Back, showing the scarring of an escaped slave, Peter Gordon, in Louisiana in 1863. So naturally, Trump wants that removed from national parks, museums. We don't want to dwell on the bad stuff, right? Just show the happy, generous white people that are the foundation of America. Let me give you some examples. Signs that address sea level rise and climate change at Cape Hatteras National Seashore is one. Others that explain how Native Americans were forced off park land. And there are even references to the impact of urbanization and agriculture on the Everglades. There was one park employee who wrote that could, quote, be seen as, quote, disparaging the development of industrial America. NPR asks, all right, now you've been talking to people inside the Park Service. Are they all on board with all of this? Well, I mean, some no doubt do agree with the president, are helping with this. But others I've talked to say that most people don't like it. They say employees are mostly flagging these signs as to avoid getting in trouble. And they think that this is really an attempt to erase uncomfortable parts of the country's history and control intellectual discourse. Now, park employees I've talked to, they don't want to use their names. They're afraid of being fired. But one described the Trump administration like this, quote, quote, they want to control the narrative. If you control the narrative, you control the people. Like the Republicans have tried to do this vigilante justice and deputizing random people to, you know, rat out doctors or neighbors that might be assisting women getting abortions, you know, go after them. Anyone who's, you know, aiding and abetting, they are now asking park visitors to submit troublesome signs like Native Americans were the original inhabitants of these parks, or troublesome signs that indicate our history of slavery, submit those to the U.S. government. So not only park employees, but park visitors are being deputized to whitewash our history. In detail, over the summer, the Park Service provided these QR codes for visitors to comment on any signs that they thought needed to be changed. I was leaked about 2,200 of these, and I read through them, and there's one visitor who flagged a sign on territorial expansion. It said Native Americans were, quote, starved into submission to the white man's will, and the visitor found that was, you know, pretty stark and reductive. We have comment periods in America that are basically, you know, dog and pony shows for pipelines, for other environmental projects that the public are widely against. One example was the Cop City militarized police compound that we covered on the ground, thanks to you supporting us. Those were the protests against that totally unnecessary, frankly, imperial monstrosity police compound in the Atlanta area public protected forest. And all the public comments were against it. All the people were against it at city council meeting. Of course, the corrupt government, in that case, Democrats, rubber stamped it through anyway. Fortunately, a judge just dismissed the insane domestic terrorism charges against 61 of the protesters who did nothing other than peacefully protest. They were stuck in this hellish court case being charged as domestic terrorists. But I bring this up because public comments are usually completely ignored if it has to do with people being against environmental oil pipelines, mining sites, data centers that are popping up all over the place. But now, in the reverse, oh no, the Trump administration, they want the public comments, and they are going to use public comments from bigots saying, yeah, we should remove these signs about Native Americans once being here and forced off the land, or these signs or images of, you know, slaves being tortured to death with scarred backs. Let's get rid of them. They're reductive. Those public comments they like. Public comments against, you know, toxic, deadly, cancerous pipelines, mines, factories, plants. We're just going to dismiss those. It's just disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. And it kind of goes with the attack. Donald Trump's been attacking Native Americans his whole life, especially his business life. But it goes to just a few months ago, him trying to get rid of birthright citizenship, basically by questioning the origin of birthright citizenship, Native Americans. Trump's longstanding desire to end birthright citizenship took a dramatic turn in late January with the issuance of an executive order aimed at eliminating the constitutional right that grants citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil. The bold move, if successful, would overturn more than a century of established legal precedent rooted in the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. However, a federal judge quickly intervened, temporarily blocking the order after 22 states mounted a swift legal challenge. The 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, clearly states that, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the U.S. This clause has been the foundation for countless legal battles that have gradually expanded citizenship rights to various marginalized and oppressed groups. Trump's executive order, however, hinges on the interpretation of the phrase, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Trump's Justice Department, in defending the order, has cited historical legal cases to argue that birth within the U.S. alone doesn't automatically confer citizenship. A key element of that is the Elk versus Wilkins case argument based on the 1884 Supreme Court case Elk versus Wilkins. This case involved John Elk, a Ho-Chunk man who left his tribal nation and settled in Omaha, Nebraska, claiming birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. Supreme Court ruled against Elk, stating that Native Americans, due to their allegiance to their tribes, were not subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. and thus not entitled to citizenship. And why is this important? You know, who goes to national parks? Of course, all of us can, but, you know, people, you know, parents take their kids on vacation to a lot of areas with national parks. They go hiking, you know, they stay at hotels nearby, have picnics, see monuments, whatever. This is, in many cases, since our teachings on Native American history are so awful in actual grade school. I mean, I was shocked when I went to Standing Rock and I actually spoke with Native Americans and learned a lot more than I was taught in regular public school. So a lot of the first exposure kids get to any semblance of the real history of America, which is genocide, murder, rape, kidnapping, happens at these parks. And now Trump wants to remove the signs, not just towards Native Americans, but our genocide and murder towards Black people. I mean, it's just vile and disgusting. It's truly vile and disgusting. And if you're MAGA watching and you think this is some great thing, and hey, Jordan, let the past be the past. Let's focus on, you know, the good parts of America. Well, when you whitewash the bad parts, you then history repeats itself over and over again when you whitewash history. We will stay on this. If you're a Native American watching, if you are a Black viewer watching, if you know of things like this happening in your community where the Trump administration or local government, Republican governments are trying to push the removal of certain artifacts, signs, museum items, please let us know. info@statusquo.com, info@statusquo.com. And please support Status Quo as a paying member for as low as 16 cents a day. That's statusquo.com/join.
New York City. At the United Nations headquarters, the Palestinian question takes center stage at a special summit during the General Assembly. Leaders from around the world gather, not simply to debate history, but to weigh the future of one of the most enduring conflicts of our time. The mood in the chamber is heavy with expectation. For decades, the idea of a two-state solution has hovered over negotiations, but this summit carries a sense of urgency, of shifting global winds. Delegations from Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia file in. cameras capture their arrival. Emmanuel Macron of France, Antonio Guterres of the United Nations, Annalena Baerbock of Germany, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Each represents not only their own nation, but a voice in a broader chorus. Yet two delegations are conspicuously absent, Israel and the United States. Their empty seats will become one of the most powerful images of the day, a silence that speaks volumes. French President Emmanuel Macron formally opens the proceedings. His words, delivered in French, mark the resumption of this high-level plenary session dedicated to the peaceful resolution of the Palestinian question and the two-state solution. His speech is greeted with applause from the Palestinian delegation. The camera pans across the room, applause on one side, empty chairs on another. The visual contrast illustrates both momentum and division. Then the summit's tone is sharpened by the voice of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. With unmistakable clarity, he reminds the assembly that statehood for the Palestinians is not a gift to be granted, but a right long denied. He warns that denying recognition would fuel extremism worldwide, and that without two states, there can be no peace in the Middle East. His words hang over the chamber like a challenge, not only to the absent Israelis and Americans, but to every leader present. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez follows. He calls this conference a historic milestone, yet he stresses it is only the beginning. His proposal is specific. Palestine must be granted full membership in the United Nations on equal footing with every other state, and the process must not drag on. His demand is clear. Recognition through words must be matched by recognition through action. Egypt's Prime Minister Mostafa Madbouly speaks next, linking recognition with the urgent humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He pledges that once a ceasefire is secured, Egypt will host a global reconstruction conference to rebuild Gaza and mobilize Arab Islamic plans for recovery. His message resonates beyond diplomacy. Recognition cannot mean survival on paper alone. It must mean survival in homes, schools, and hospitals for the Palestinian people. From Europe, Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, strikes a similar tone. She announces the creation of a dedicated European instrument for Gaza's reconstruction, calling on international donors to join in. But she also adds a sobering note. Only Israelis and Palestinians can ultimately decide their future. The role of the international community, she insists, is to keep hope alive until the parties themselves find the courage to reconcile. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney offers realism. He acknowledges that recognition is no panacea, no quick solution to decades of mistrust and violence. But he places Canada's support firmly on the principles of self-determination and human rights enshrined in the UN Charter. By aligning with a coordinated effort led by France and Saudi Arabia, Carney frames Canada's move as one of principle and pragmatism, a step toward keeping the possibility of peace alive. Then comes Belgium's Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, whose words draw both attention and caution. Belgium, he declares, will recognize Palestine legally only once Hamas is removed from governance and hostages are released. He sets conditions tied to demilitarization and democratic renewal, promising an embassy and full diplomatic ties only once these benchmarks are met. His statement reflects Europe's cautious approach, where recognition is seen not just as symbolic, but conditional on internal reform. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese narrows the lens to the day after recognition. He stresses that recognition must be followed by reconstruction, reform, and credible peace plans. Gaza must be rebuilt, Israel must be secure, and Hamas must be excluded from governance, not just in principle, but in daily practice. For him, recognition is not an end, but the start of a process that must be managed carefully, cooperatively, and collectively. And then South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa adds a voice of solidarity rooted in history. He welcomes the groundswell of international support for Palestine, noting that 142 nations now back its establishment. His words carry the weight of South Africa's own past, drawing a quiet parallel between the Palestinian struggle and his nation's long fight against apartheid. As the speeches unfold, a pattern emerges. The calls for recognition are near universal, yet the conditions attached vary. Spain demands immediate UN membership. Egypt focuses on rebuilding Gaza. The European Union pushes resources but calls for local leadership. Canada ties its support to principle, Belgium to conditions on Hamas, Australia to reconstruction, and South Africa to solidarity. Each voice adds a different texture to the larger mosaic, a chorus both united and fractured. But while leaders speak, the absence of Israel and the United States looms over the chamber. The empty chairs of two powerful nations act as silent counterarguments to the calls for recognition. For the Palestinians, applause signals hope. For skeptics, silence underscores resistance. The divide is not only geographic but philosophical. Should recognition precede negotiations, or must negotiations come first? This summit, however, signals a shift in global sentiment. For decades, recognition of Palestine was largely symbolic, backed by some nations, rejected by others, ignored by many. Now it has moved from the margins to the center of global diplomacy. Leaders openly discuss reconstruction funds, diplomatic conditions, and UN membership as if recognition is no longer hypothetical but inevitable. The implications are profound. If Palestine becomes a full UN member, it would alter the dynamics of international law, bilateral relations, and negotiations with Israel. It would give Palestinians greater legitimacy on the world stage, but could also deepen the rift with nations opposed to recognition. The absence of the US suggests Washington is unwilling, at least for now, to support such a move, fearing its impact on Israeli security and its influence in the region. Yet global politics is shifting. The summit reflects a new alignment where European nations, Arab states, and countries from the global south find common ground. In a world redefined by crises in Ukraine, Taiwan, and climate change, the Palestinian question is once again forcing its way into the spotlight as a test of the international community's willingness to address injustice. For Palestinians, this moment is both symbolic and strategic. Symbolic because applause from world leaders echoes their long-held demand for recognition. Strategic because reconstruction pledges and UN membership proposals could turn symbolism into practical gains. But the road ahead is fraught with obstacles. Internal Palestinian divisions, the presence of Hamas, ongoing Israeli security concerns, and the enduring absence of consensus among the world's most powerful nations. For Israelis, the summit presents both a challenge and a warning. A growing number of nations now recognize Palestine, and the momentum could isolate Israel diplomatically if it remains opposed. For the United States, silence at the summit speaks of its reluctance to break with its closest Middle Eastern ally, but that silence also risks ceding influence to other powers, France, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and even South Africa, who are shaping the conversation. As the summit draws to a close, one conclusion becomes clear. Palestinian statehood is no longer a fringe demand, but a mainstream expectation in much of the world. Recognition may still be debated, delayed, or conditional, but it has moved to the center of international diplomacy. The UN summit in New York, marked by applause, pledges, and empty chairs, may not deliver peace tomorrow, but it has redrawn the diplomatic map of the conflict. For Palestinians, this is a moment of momentum. For Israelis, a moment of caution. For the world, a moment of reckoning. The question is no longer whether recognition is possible, but whether it will be the first step toward peace or yet another chapter in a conflict that refuses to end. And so, as the cameras fade from New York, one truth remains undeniable. The question of Palestine has returned to the forefront of world politics, and the call for recognition is louder than it has ever been.
La cinquième séance plénière de la conférence internationale de
high-level international conference for the peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine and the implementation of the two-state solution is resumed.
Time has come because there's a pressing urgency everywhere and for our universal conscience. We condemn it unequivocally because nothing in Gaza with the stated objective of destroying Hamas.
But
hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced.
forcefully condemned the terrorist attacks committed on the 7th of October 2023. He reiterated his young man terrible, when I learned of Rabin. The horrible assassination of Yitzhak Rabin.
Je remercie le secrétaire général de l'Organisation des Nations Unies. Je remercie Madame la Présidente de l'Assemblée Générale. J'invite à présent
le Prime Minister of Belgium.
Stage, and let's be clear, statehood for the Palestinians is a right, not a reward. And denying statehood would be a gift to extremists everywhere. Without two states, there will be no peace in the Middle East, and radicalism will spread around the world.
Excelencias, esta conferencia marca un hito trascendental, pero no es el final del camino, solo es, debe ser, el principio. Por eso, quiero hacer dos propuestas. La primera es que el Estado de Palestina debe ser miembro de pleno derecho en Naciones Unidas. Se debe completar lo antes posible el procedimiento de ingreso del Estado de Palestina en esta organización en pie de igualdad con el resto de estados. Y en segundo lugar,
tenemos... لحشد التمويل اللازم للخطة العربية الإسلامية لإعادة الإعمار بالتنسيق مع الحكومة الفلسطينية بما يضمن بقاء الشعب الفلسطيني على أرضه ومساعدته على تجاوز الخسائر الجسيمة التي سببها العدوان وإنني أدعو كل شركائنا في المجتمع الدولي للمساهمة في هذا الجهد للتعافي المبكر ولإعادة الإعمار بوصفه جزءا لا يتجزأ من أي تحرك جدي لتحويل حل الدولتين إلى واقع ملموس. السيدات والسادة، إننا نقف اليوم أمام لحظة
We'll set up a dedicated instrument for Gaza's reconstruction in coordination with other donors' efforts. Gaza must be rebuilt, the Palestinian economy must be relaunched, and I invite all of you to join in the effort to make this happen. Of course, in the end, only the Israelis and the Palestinians can agree on the way forward. But the international community has so much to contribute. We can facilitate, we can rebuild, but most importantly, we can keep hope alive. Thank you very much.
Excellencies, Canada is under no illusions that this recognition is a panacea. This recognition is, however, firmly aligned with the principles of self-determination and fundamental human rights in the UN Charter, and it is fundamentally consistent with the policy of the Canadian government for generations. We take this action as part of a coordinated effort led by France and Saudi Arabia, a coordinated effort to provide the possibility of peace and a two-state solution. Recognizing the state of Palestine
will proceed to the legal recognition of the state of Palestine once all hostages have been released and all terrorist organizations such as Hamas have been removed from the governance of Palestine. The effective conduct of diplomatic relations with the new state of Palestine, including the opening of a Belgian embassy and the conclusion of international agreements, will be carried out once the objectives of the New York Declaration have been achieved, notably the full demilitarization of Hamas and subsequent the renewal of governments based on presidential and parliamentary elections, giving the Palestinians a democratic, strengthened and renewed authority. All these steps are intended to guarantee
that future depends on recognition being followed by reconstruction and reform, a credible cooperative peace plan supporting recovery in Gaza and security for Israel, establishing governance and excluding Hamas on the day after and every day after that. This is the next step we must take, and we must take it together. I thank you very much.
Solution. I would like to welcome the demonstrable groundswell of support for the establishment of the much-awaited state of Israel, of Palestine by 142 nations.
And finally today,
the Trump administration is telling pregnant women not to use acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, to avoid having children with autism.
You'll be uncomfortable. It won't be as easy, maybe. But don't take it. If you're pregnant, don't take Tylenol.
Medical groups say there's no clear evidence showing a causal link. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports the National Institutes of Health just awarded more than $50 million in research grants to explore the roots of autism.
NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya said the 13 new grants will help scientists consider the effect of environmental and medical factors, everything from nutrition to pollutants. He said past NIH research on autism has not given families the answers they wanted. The NIH did, however, fund one very large study looking at acetaminophen use in pregnancy and the risk of autism. It analyzed data from more than 2 million children in Sweden and found no connection. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Nearly a week after ABC pulled Jimmy Kimmel live off the air, not all ABC viewers will be able to watch the broadcast show.
The Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC, says it originally suspended Jimmy Kimmel for what they said were his ill-timed and thus insensitive remarks after the murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. On his show last week, Kimmel made fun of Trump's reaction to the killing and accused MAGA of using it to score political points. Disney says after days of thoughtful conversations with Kimmel, the show would return. Free speech advocates cheered the news. So did fellow late night host Stephen Colbert during his monologue last night.
Come on!
Even so, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, which operates ABC affiliates in 30 markets, says it will still not carry Jimmy Kimmel live. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
The White House has strongly denied an MSNBC report that border czar Tom Homan was recorded a year ago accepting a bag with $50,000 in cash. The report said this was part of an undercover FBI operation later shut down by Trump administration officials. NPR has not confirmed this reporting. White House spokeswoman Caroline Levitt dismissed the report.
Mr. Homan never took the $50,000 that you're referring to, so you should get your facts straight, number one. Number two, this was another example of the weaponization of the Biden Department of Justice against one of President Trump's strongest and most vocal supporters in the midst of a presidential campaign.
MSNBC reports Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee say they plan to look into the matter. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued an emergency order. It allows President Trump to fire the last remaining Democratic member of the Federal Trade Commission. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court's action is technically temporary, since the justices will hear arguments in the case in December. But by allowing the firing of Rebecca Slaughter from the Federal Trade Commission, the court seems all but certain to overturn a nearly century-old precedent that barred presidents from firing members of bipartisan regulatory agencies, except for bad conduct. Dissenting for the court's three liberals, Justice Elena Kagan noted that Congress enacted the bipartisan agency framework. She said the emergency docket should not be used, as it was here, to transfer government authority from Congress to the president and thus to reshape the nation's separation of powers. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he's canceling a meeting this week with top congressional Democrats. Writing online last hour, Trump says it wouldn't be productive. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries said this morning they had agreed to meet this week. They're trying to reach an agreement on a federal government spending plan. If Congress does not pass a spending agreement, the federal government will shut down next week. Democrats have been demanding that Republicans rescind enormous cuts in federal health care programs before they'll support a spending plan. Trump called these demands unserious and ridiculous. President Trump is in New York. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump is expected to speak out against Western allies who have recognized a Palestinian state or plan to do so.
Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says President Trump will deliver a speech touting the administration's accomplishments while criticizing the work of international organizations like the United Nations.
The president will also touch upon how globalist institutions have significantly decayed the world order, and he will articulate his straightforward and constructive vision for the world.
She says the president will also be meeting together with the leaders of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, as well as have one-on-one meetings with the leaders of Ukraine and the European Union. The visit comes as the president has become more isolated in the UN, where there is a growing push to recognize a Palestinian state. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
A new U.S.-based joint venture is proposing to take control of the video-sharing app TikTok under a deal being negotiated with China. The venture would be able to retrain TikTok's content algorithm using U.S. data. The White House says the algorithm was a tough point of negotiation that needed to meet requirements of U.S. and Chinese law. TikTok faced a ban in the U.S. over security concerns. President Trump has repeatedly paused the ban since taking office. Danish police are investigating who flew two or three very large drones over Copenhagen Airport night for hours. These were so large they could not be shot down. Police said there were too many nearby passengers. Danish officials say it's a serious attack on critical infrastructure.
Thank you for listening.
It's a time of tremendous uncertainty for everyone, but some things haven't changed. Stomach cancer is still a leading cause of cancer death worldwide. More than 1 million people will be diagnosed this year alone, and it's vital to know your risks and learn ways to prevent it. It's also critical for cancer patients to protect themselves from all viruses. No Stomach for Cancer encourages you to listen to medical experts to understand your risks. Find out more about COVID-19 at cancer.gov and learn more about your risks for stomach cancer at nostomachforcancer.org.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norwood, your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Asthma affects 25 million people nationwide, and every day 10 people die with it, with African American women and children being most at risk. Early warning signs include coughing, especially at night, or with exercise and wheezing. Almost all asthma can be effectively managed with a good action plan. So talk with your doctor today. And for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
You are listening to an experiment.